Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Film Baby Film, the podcast for people who love movies. My name is John Lobinger, and I am joined today by Robert Taylor. Very excited to share this episode with you. I was just re-listening to it after we recorded this earlier in the month. But as many of you know, Bergman 100 happened, so I wanted to get out the terrific conversation I had with Becky DeAnna regarding First Reformed and Winter Light to celebrate Bergman's birthday. So put this, we delayed this until after that episode came out, and now you're listening to it. But so after that delay, went back and listened to the episode, and a really just a terrific conversation. I really enjoy talking to Robert. He's, I consider him a friend as well as a great podcaster. Somebody that we've podcasted before over on David Blakesley's Criterion Reflections. Definitely check out his podcast if you get a chance. It's a great show for people that are fans of the Criterion Collection. Anyways, Robert's a terrific guy to talk to. Really smart, knows a lot about movies, works in the movies, works in television, and was just a really great conversation. He suggested this movie, which is Purge Anarchy, the second of the four Purge films. And it was an interesting selection. I hadn't seen it before, and I was really glad that I watched it. It was a great movie to watch, but it turned into a bit of a launching pad to talk about lots of other topics, both the social commentary that occurs in the movie, but also getting to talk about the movie empire that Jason Blum is forming. Definitely people that know about Roger Corman and what he did, you can definitely see a lot of similarities. So great conversation, both about this film, which was a surprisingly good film for me in my first time watch, as well as lots of other topics, and just had a great time talking to him. So coming up in August, I think what my plan is to try to get out a couple of episodes every month, put out an episode every couple of weeks. And so what I think we're going to be doing is we're going to have a couple of my attorney friends on, and we're going to discuss All the President's Men. About the Washington Post reporting that eventually took down President Nixon. So, and then we're also going to do an episode with Matt Gasteyer. I'm just finalizing the timing on that, and we'll be discussing the Visconti retrospective. So we'll be looking at Visconti's, I don't know if it's going to be his entire career or just a few of the key highlights or whatever, but that's definitely going to be exciting. Matt's a great guy, and I really enjoyed watching all those Visconti films this summer. So lots of good things coming up, but this episode here with Robert Taylor discussing Purge Anarchy, one of my favorite conversations I've had on the podcast. Really excited that you're all going to get to listen to it. So without any further ado, let's do it. Robert Taylor, Purge Anarchy, Film Baby Film.
So, how is your life, John?
My life is good, man. It's good. I'm still not working, and that has to change at some point soon. And so, it does. And I'm coming out of hibernation, which is I'm really procrastinating that.
I mean, I'm fine with that. Procrastination is the best. I'm a writer, so we like to procrastinate all the time. I'm doing it right now by doing this podcast with you.
You know what the main thing is that I'm procrastinating on? Is the way that I'm procrastinating? Because all of the stuff that I need to do to get a job is actually not all that difficult in terms of if I want to go back to an office job. Mm-hmm. But there's the first step is I have to update my resume. And I've just decided that that is impossible for me to start.
Oh, it's the worst. Plus, you have to, write the LinkedIn page, because everyone cares about the LinkedIn page. They don't really care about your resume. Just give us your LinkedIn profile. That's all they really need. And then it's like, who the fuck uses LinkedIn anymore?
It's So I had a job at the same company for 10 years. So I literally never updated my LinkedIn after like my first semester of business school. So I don't even know what the password is to that thing. And yeah, no, the whole thing is just like, but the, I mean, the good thing is that the economy is really strong right now. There's like basically 0% unemployment, particularly for anybody that's with postgraduate education. And my field in particular, if I go back to being an actuary, is like 0% unemployment. So that's good, I guess.
You're just like, but that resume, I can't write that one line that says I was with a company for 10 years.
You know, but yeah, I guess it's, you know, I'm really grateful to the new founding fathers for the purge and the low unemployment that's come with it.
Yes, I am grateful as well. I love that it's gotten more prescient in just 4 years.
So can we talk about this? So I'm not even going to hold off on it. So what I'm thinking is I know a lot about you, but the people that listen to my podcast might not know as much. And so I certainly want to get a little bit of your background so people know who you are and what you do. But I think that's kind of like a – so first of all, the president in this is named Donald Turnbull. Right?
Yes.
Oh, and so – I never saw Election Year, the movie that came after this, but apparently Election Year, the tag to the film is Keep America Great.
Yeah.
And that is also Donald Trump's re-election campaign slogan.
Exactly. And then the ones for the new Purge, the one that's coming out this summer, which is called The First Purge and is a prequel to the first three, is just the Donald Trump hat. Like, that's all it is. If you look up the preview posters, it's just the thing that I love about it is that the movies are inherently, you know, Republican-centric, right? It's a bunch of gunplay, it's a bunch of violence, go guns, etc., etc. And yet, every single one of the movies is like, yeah, fuck Republicans.
I love the bait and switch, but it's, oh gosh. So it is a little bit of... It's marketing genius, right? Jason Blum, I think that's – we should dedicate at least like 15 minutes just to talk about how much I kind of love Jason Blum. And I don't know anything about him, so maybe he's a terrible human being. But in terms of just like business model and the sort of movies that he's been behind, I really am just a huge fan.
Yeah, my friends who worked with him also said that he is annoyingly nice.
Oh, that makes me so happy.
But when you look at his movies, and I had written this on the, I think the, do you pronounce it Geyer or Gyre?
It's pronounced Geyer, even though there's no word ever that is that, and that's why we decided to pronounce it that way.
Well, I actually like many of the films that he's, that are the output of Blumhouse, and I think that the genius thing that he is doing is he's just retelling classic stories with one slight twist, and that's it. Like, Unfriended is essentially 10 Little Indians. Or the third Insidious movie is Rear Window with ghosts. So he's just taking all the movies that, and stories that we used to love growing up, and then he'll just twist it into a modern-day storytelling, which is why I think they're all huge successes. This, for example, is Most Dangerous Game.
Happy Death Day is Groundhog's Day, but crossed with Scream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, and you can just go through the entire thing. But I had posted on the Geyer, I was like, hey, we have to release two movies from Blumhouse on Criterion. And the reaction was, I'm sure you saw, several members were like, I would rather the company go out of business.
So I think now, though, it's kind of easy to pick some of the movies that would be considered in, because Whiplash is a Blumhouse production,
yeah,
and so
Whiplash
is Get Out.
Whiplash is amazing. Get Out is amazing. Hush is, I think, one of the best thrillers in the past 10 years. Creep and Creep 2 are pretty fucking creepy. Like, they live up to their name. And The Gift, did you see The Gift with Jason Bateman?
I have not, no. Wait, is that the one where somebody comes to your door with a box and you press it? Oh, okay.
That's the box. The Gift is one of the most interesting films in terms of how it's structured. Act 1 is completely from Jason Bateman's point of view. Act 2 is completely from Rebecca Hall's point of view, and then you begin to distrust Jason Bateman, and then Act 3 is where in Joel Edgerton, who is ostensibly the villain of the piece's point of view, and it gets to the point where you are so sympathetic with the villain that when the climax happens, which I will not spoil since you have not seen it, when the climax happens, it's that much more impactful because you so care about the villain and you were so identifying with him. So, if you have not yet seen The Gift, how about this? It costs probably $4.99 to rent on iTunes. If you rent it and you don't like it, I will buy you a venti Starbucks of your choice.
I will definitely check that out. I mean, looking at his movies, so if you go in the Blumhouse Productions Wikipedia page, they do just a straight up lineup of his films. Mm-hmm. The number of his films that cost like $5 million to make and then turned around and made $100 million or $200 million. on the movies that he makes that hit, he prints money out of thin air.
Mm-hmm.
He is the new Roger Corman.
And it's also hilarious because the movies that you think would be big hits, Gem and the Holograms, those are the ones that don't hit. But the ones where he's like, let's resurrect M. Night Shyamalan's career by giving him a found footage movie. That makes $100 million.
Absolutely. And I kind of dig how he's also investing in these people who are basically toxic in Hollywood and then saying, you know, come work for me. And if you make a movie on budget, and especially if it makes any money, you literally can have a job for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
That's kind of, I don't know. There's a part of me that likes that underdog story of, you know, the guy who just made Stealth and had one of the biggest bombs, you know, in the last decade or whatever. He then gets to go and make a $50 million film with Jennifer Lopez.
Yeah.
So I definitely, I'm a fan of the business model. I'm glad to hear that Blum is like a great guy, and I'm a fan of the movie too. So I'm glad you forced me to finally sit down and watch it. I have not watched very many of the Blumhouse films.
Oh, I have, and let me tell you. As I said, I'm shocked at how good many of them are. For my money, like, Paranormal Activity 2 and 3 are actually legitimate, good, scary movies. Have you seen either of them?
No, I only saw the first Paranormal Activity.
Which is meh, right?
I didn't find it to be that scary, absolutely.
So the third Paranormal Activity, the second one is quite good, but the third one in particular has one of the most ingenious suspense techniques I've ever seen on film. And I've seen a lot of film, but they mount the camera on an oscillating fan so that it takes in the entire room. And so the camera will slowly go back and forth tracking the room, and you will see something just at the very left corner of the frame, and then it turns away. And so you have to wait 20 seconds for it to get back and show whatever we saw there. So
I'm glad you mentioned that. That is one of the devices in the film It Follows, which I found to be absolutely chilling. And It Follows, it's a 360 degree look around the school room.
Yeah.
The classroom. And so it's a 360 degree look, and all of a sudden you see, as it's panning by the window, you see somebody coming towards the window. But then you have to wait until the camera comes back around to see how fast they're coming or to see if they're a bad guy.
And Paranormal was there 4 years beforehand.
That's very impressive.
But I'm just looking through, like, Oculus. Mike Flanagan is now one of the biggest directors. He's doing the sequel to The Shining, for Christ's sake.
Oh, wow.
He did The Normal Heart for HBO, so he doesn't just do horror movies. The Town That Dreaded Sundown. The remake was 10 times better than the crappy 1970s movie. Just one after the other after the other. And the other thing is, I think he can tell when he has a franchise that isn't working as well as he does. And then he fixes it en route. The first Ouija was nearly unwatchable. And then the second Ouija comes out, different director, different story set in the 1980s, and they go for E.T., at least for the first half, and you're totally emotionally engaged with it.
So, we of all the Blumhouse films that you could have recommended, it sounds like you've seen a lot of them, you decided to recommend very specifically Purge Anarchy. Why is it that you decided to recommend this one?
Well, it's like I mentioned to you, and I'm going to re-mention right now, since the people listening to the podcast have no idea what I'm talking about. I think it's the best movie that John Carpenter never directed. It has that wonderful grindhouse feel. I feel like it's prescient today. I'm so impressed by how bold it is and how much they get accomplished on a $5 to $10 million budget. I think that the cast is on par with the best ensembles of these tight action films. It feels like a great 1980s movie, but when it came out, because it's a sequel to The First Purge, which, have you seen the first one? I don't like The First Purge at all.
So I'm telling you, with the exception of Get Out and oh, gosh, what was the other? I mean, I've just Get Out and Whiplash are the only Blumhouse films I've seen. And that's not because I'm anti-B-movie. I love horror films of all different, you know, budget levels or sophistication or whatever, however you want to call it. But I just never got around to watching any of these. And I found Purge Anarchy to be way more interesting than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, so the first Purge came out, and it was fine. It made $100 million, I think, because Ethan Hawke was in it, and he had just done Sinister with Blumhouse. And it was passable. It was like a solid C. It was the Purge in a single house with a group outside the house. And they introduced this very interesting science fiction-y theme of, we're going to have one night where all crime is legal. And the premise was more interesting than the film turned out to be. It was more like a ripoff of The Strangers. Then, so I had no interest in seeing the sequel. And then four of my friends dragged me. Like, actually, they told me that we were watching a different movie. And then we got there and they told me I was watching Purge Anarchy, which I did not enjoy. And so I went into the movie with the lowest of expectations. And it completely blew me the fuck away. I could not believe that the same writer-director from the first one created the second one. I was shocked. I walked out and I said, this is great. It's never going to get any respect because the first movie sucked. And the movie is called The Purge Anarchy. Who's going to take a movie called The Purge Anarchy seriously?
Right.
And so I was just beating my little drum on Facebook for about 6 months, and everyone who saw it told me that I wasn't crazy. It actually is a great movie. And of course it's not a perfect movie. There are issues that we'll get into in the next couple of, you know, over the next hour, we'll get into what some of my issues with it are. But I think that it sort of is one of those movies that skims greatness. It's almost there, and it, because it tries so many different things, I am more willing to forgive the parts that don't work, because I'd rather have a movie that throws everything at the wall and doesn't quite hit everything, but at least it tried. Then I watched the third movie, and the third movie is back to being mediocre. There's one amazing scene in the third film, which you said you hadn't seen, where this girl in a ballerina costume pulls up in a VW Beetle that's covered in fairy lights, like she has wrapped the entire Beetle with fairy lights. She pops out of the car, and inside of it is playing Miley Cyrus's Party in the USA. And she has a bat that is covered in barbed wire. That one little image is incredible, but the rest of the movie is meh. That said, I still love this movie. And I had seen it twice in theaters and hadn't seen it since, so I was, since you agreed that this was the podcast we were going to do, I was like, fuck, I hope it holds up. I hope I wasn't crazy. And then I watched it and I was like, no, it does hold up. I'm very happy.
So I think the reason that this film makes so much money is because there is, the concept of it has It markets itself, and it markets itself on so many different levels. There's like a vengeance wish fulfillment thing going on. Like, oh man, if there were 12 hours where I could just do whatever I wanted, like, you know, what would I do? And that appeals to some people. Anarchy appeals to other people. And in addition, like, appears, I think, in some of the marketing, particularly Purge Anarchy, it appeals to conservative fears of, like, gang violence, MS-13, you know, racial fears. And what's interesting is then once you buy the ticket, you know, if you bought the ticket based off of those things, or just, you know, if you bought the ticket for because you wanted to see an exciting film, you then get in, and it's a fairly relentless, like, liberal ideological onslaught after that.
Yep. It's one of the very rare films that can have its cake and eat it, too. It can be an incredibly bloody, violent movie as it's preaching, this is wrong.
Yeah, there is an element, of course, that reminds me of, like, when I read The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Because Larson, basically, all three of his books are, like, very feminist. That, mm-hmm. you know, just constantly reiterating feminist themes. But at the same time, the selling point for the entire series is a very graphic rape scene. Mm-hmm. Like, that is the core of the entire book series, is that one violent act that takes place in the first book. So it's like, wait a second. It's like, I see what you're doing here, and this makes me feel very uncomfortable.
Exactly.
But this, I think, makes me feel... It's still there, though, right? Like, when you first... So now we're going to get into the stuff of the film. And for anybody that's listening, you know, Purge Anarchy's been out for 3 years. It made $100 million. Like, you can see it anywhere. We're definitely going to get into spoilers. I always get into spoilers, so I don't even know why I'm doing the preamble, but there we are. So when you launch into this film, like, fairly early on, there is that... racial fear is played very quickly. The first jump scare that you get is when a black guy wearing white face paint and a cross painted on his head, he basically mm-hmm. looks like a tribal figure, comes slamming up against the middle class white couple, their car. Yep. And that's like the first jump scare. And so as I'm settling in, I'm like, okay, that's what this movie's going to be about.
Yep. But then what is so interesting about the film is it introduces all of these cliches and then it upends them. It turns out that black gang, who the guy has the hockey mask that says God on it, and the guy who had the tribal face paint, as you mentioned, they're not even purging. They're out there just trying to get money.
They're working for the rich white people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so you think, oh, these guys obviously have to be the ultimate villains. They're the ones who are in all of the commercials. They're the ones who are in all of the posters, front and center. You're like, these people are going to be the ultimate villains of the piece. And as you said, the first jump scare is the white couple is being smashed into by the black guy in the tribal mask. And yet, the movie then goes out of its way to rewrite that narrative.
Yeah, and so what is it? So the mother and daughter pair, that's Eva and Callie Sanchez, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so that their storyline sets up. So the very first shot in the film is a shot of one crumpled $1 bills.
Yep.
So right there, you know, no subtlety. This is going to be a movie that's going to be at the core of it is going to be like socioeconomic conflict.
Yes, plus, again, it's called The Purge Anarchy. We don't go in it expecting subtlety.
No, there's no subtlety. And then immediately the woman, she's clearly struggling with money because she needs to ask her boss, who's white, needs to ask her for a raise, and it's about her father's medical. But so right off the bat, it's like, okay, so I'm already ticking off. So she's Latina. She needs to ask her white boss for more money. It's about the high cost of pharmacy, you know, drugs for her dad. You know, yeah. It's just starting to like tick off boxes right away. But then we're introduced to the second storyline, and that is the opposite. That's like Charles Bronson, Dirty Harry. This is like a guy with a a good guy with a gun on a vendetta.
Yes.
And that is
they killed my son. I will have my vengeance.
And that is kind of an impressive Frank Grillo, who you kind as I watch that I think to myself, if this wasn't as low budget, they would have hired John Bernthal for that role.
Oh yeah.
Like if they wanted to hire a name, they would have hired the guy that eventually played the Punisher on Netflix.
Mm-hmm. But Grillo, especially in the climactic scene where he's breaking down about to kill the guy, great. He's great. Before that, you know, it's not a performance where you need to put a lot into it. But I think in the finale he does quite well.
He also does pretty well in the one instance where he's supposed to do some comic relief when he's joking around with Callie. And Callie says, you're either a cop or you're a criminal. You're good with guns, so you're either a cop or a criminal. He said, well, you're either a pain in my ass or a pain in my ass. Like, he actually delivered the joke pretty well. So, you know. I feel like for me, he was the standout performance just because I was expecting so little from him that I actually thought he was able to carry the film fairly well. And again, a guy that has a job for life with Blumhouse, because I think he's doing his next movies with Naomi Watts, Once Upon a Time in Staten Island.
Which is by the same writer-director as The Purge.
Perfect.
And he was in The Purge 3, spoiler alert. And then we can't forget about the married couple who are about to go through a divorce, and again, rewriting our expectations. You're going to see a movie called The Purge. You're like, oh, this couple's getting a divorce. I wonder if the night's going to end well for them. And you expect, you know, either the guy to lose it and try and kill the woman or the woman to lose it and attempt to kill him. But surprise, surprise, they bond over the course of the evening and they recommit themselves to their marriage. And when he dies, probably one of the most emotional moments of the movie is when she metaphorically becomes one of the villains by saying, I need to purge. I need to actually become what we were running from in order to grieve the death of my husband.
Yeah, I kind of love that part. So apparently they're that acting pair, they're married in real life.
Aww. I mean, boo, because Zach Gilford, I want to be my husband, but it's fine.
I think that's just, like, more bang for your buck. They're, like, doing casting. They're like, wait a second, you're already married? Perfect.
Yes.
And the film is, the film gives you a lot of, like I said, the film, particularly in the beginning, gives you a lot of the things that it advertises, right? Like, there's the shot of the MS-13 type Latino gang in the bus, and you're like, okay, that's coming. And then there's the a gang that's predominantly black people, and they're riding around in the, I don't know, is that an ice cream truck?
It was either an ice cream truck or like a furniture moving truck, whatever. We'll say ice cream truck because that seems more interesting.
So one of the stylistic influences on this film is absolutely the PlayStation game Twisted Metal.
I don't play it, so I will take your word for it.
When I was in high school, we'd play this game, and what you would do is it was basically like a hyper destruction, destruction derby, like one of those car derbies you'd see at the fair. But instead of just being like with junkers or jalopies, it would be with it was with a school bus, it was with a 16-wheeler truck, and it was with an ice cream truck. And so those are literally the vehicles in this movie. And so I think it's pretty clear they got some inspiration from there, on top of the Escape from New York. And what was that great Ice-T movie where he was the hunted?
Ghosts on Mars? Are we still talking the John Carpenter thing?
No, not John Carpenter, but there was, was it The Game? It was, Gary Busey was in it, and Ice-T got tricked into going on a hunting trip, and they hunted him.
I am just going to just keep letting you talk.
So lots of, clearly a lot of, like, cool influences going into the film. But even though they like, front load sort of the, they're really red herrings. These specific tropes, like you were saying, and then they upend them totally. Mm-hmm. Because, like you pointed out, when you get to the core of what's driving this film, it's the wealthy trying to consume the poor, and it's all about money. Like, this whole thing is about money. And this, and there's also, as the film goes on, people's relationships with the guns and with the Purge Night becomes creepier and creepier. Like, my favorite thing in the movie. So eventually, so what happens is the three different tracks of the sergeant, of Callie and Eva, and the married white couple, they all end up together.
Correct.
And
that's a great sequence, by the way. Totally suspenseful. You assume that any one of the characters could die at any moment in that sequence. And there's some real depth to it. The thing that surprised me is, do you like shaky cam? Because I fucking hate shaky cam normally.
I have no issue with shaky cam. I know that some people have, like, motion sickness issues with it, or they don't like it for some reason. I've always been fine with it.
I normally really detest it because I think that it's not used well. It's used well in films like, you know, the first 20 minutes of Saving Private Ryan, or it's used well in television in, like, Parenthood or Friday Night Lights. But I thought that shaky cam was used very effectively here because it was used to support the action without making it so anarchic that you don't understand what's going on in any given moment.
Yeah, it was kind of a... There were also a lot of points where I noticed it, and I noticed how minimalist it was. My guess is that there probably was a direction of, like, look, add style to it, but do not make it unclear. Like, do not make this confusing. And the advantage of shaky cam in a low-budget film, obviously, is that it can add action without expensive effects.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially what happens is you have an individual bad actor. You have Diego, who's the superintendent of Eva and Callie's building, breaks
Oy
in.
Vey.
Yeah. Breaks in, unfortunately, right after they discovered that their grandfather, who they'd been buying drugs for, had decided to sell himself to a rich family, sacrifice himself so that his daughter and granddaughter could live a better life, which is a very poignant moment. Right up until you saw the white family that was going to kill him, and you realized that the grandfather and the family looked just like Mitch McConnell.
Yep.
Which is my least favorite face in the world is Mitch McConnell's face.
I mean, mine is still always, always, always going to be the president of the United States. But yes, Mitch McConnell is right up there.
He reminds me of, what is it, Mason Verger? The guy from Hannibal, after he gets his face peeled off, that's who he reminds me of. Anyways.
But the scene with the grandfather was totally affecting. I had forgotten it because it's been a couple of years, and as I was watching it, I didn't tear up, but I found myself much more moved than I expected to be.
And what's interesting about it, too, is that it's imagined. It isn't supposed to be depicting what actually is happening. We know he is actually being taken to one of these rich families' houses. But what we're seeing is the subjective imagination of what the daughter and the granddaughter are envisioning is happening to their, you know, to grandpa. And that part of it is, like, that's kind of freaky.
Yeah, and it totally informs the granddaughter's POV the entire... You said her name was Callie, correct?
Yes.
And it totally informs Callie's point of view for the rest of the movie. It wasn't this one-off, although it was, of course, an interesting just little, oh, this is something else that happens in the world. It actually informs her and her point of view with Leo, as she keeps saying, there has to be another way. There's always going to be another way. And if this hadn't occurred, I feel like she would be very annoying very quickly. But because we understand that she's grieving the death of her grandfather, it resonates more than it should.
Ah, got it, got it. And the other thing that's informing Callie's perspective is that she's been watching YouTube videos, pirated YouTube videos of Carmelo Johns, the leader of the resistance movement against the new founding fathers who are behind the Purge, played by Michael K. Williams, and who must have been, he's definitely the biggest star, you know, the biggest name in this film.
Yep.
So,
and I also wonder if they told him specifically to get a Spike Lee era 1992 makeover.
What, with those glasses and the militant
with
jacket?
With the glasses and the hair, it was almost, it was spot on.
And I think he's wearing a beret when he runs into the, when he runs into the statue, the hunting statue ground at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, okay, so this all happens, and then you have the lone bad actor, you know, guy who's hopped up on drugs and is ready to, kill and rape and all of this bad stuff. But he's just like a one-off, because as soon as he comes in, he gets knocked off by paramilitary. I mean, it is. It's so rapid fire. Because, you know, obviously, they're one of the three tracks. They can't both get killed right at the beginning. And so you know something's going to intercede when this guy comes running into the house. But it's you're not necessarily expecting, like, government paramilitary. I assume they were there because they were trying to find Carmelo Johns.
Yeah, that's what I assumed as well the first time I saw it.
And so they get dragged out, and that's when Sergeant runs upon him. He's off trying to do his vigilante thing, trying to avenge the death of his son. Again, he's total Charles Bronson death wish.
Yeah, I just want to kill this one guy. Why is everyone getting in my way?
It's kind of funny. That whole moment, he's like, don't do it, don't do it. He's like fighting back to try to prevent himself from helping anybody.
And, well, you also bring up a good point. The director and writer, James DeMonaco, I think is how his name is pronounced, he increases exponentially the tension so well. You have the evil, just random rapist guy, and then you introduce the government goons, and then you introduce this. There's a scene very early on, right after the purge starts, which so perfectly sets this up, where you didn't see the first film, but there's this husband and wife who are walking down the street, and I think they have machetes in their hand, and they're getting ready to go purge. And it's sort of a callback to the first film, where there were, you know, just normal, dapper people who came into the house to murder Ethan Hawke and his family. And then they're immediately blown away by the guy with the huge machine gun in the back of the truck. The doctor, if you will. The butcher, doctor, whatever it is.
Big Daddy. And that's Big Daddy.
Big Daddy. And that's sort of a microcosm of what DeMonaco was trying to do with the entire film. He says, okay, here's the lowest stakes possible. Now let's increase and increase and increase.
Yeah, and Big Daddy... So Big Daddy is the first sort of non-conservative, like, I don't know if it's horror or thriller trope. He is, you know, wearing an American flag baseball hat, and he just looks like he should have, like, a big thing of dip in his mouth. And, you know, he goes hunting, and he only drinks Bud Heavies. Like, this guy is all-American, racist grandpa. And he just unloads on people, and he's pretty hardcore established as like a big bad right off the bat. I mean,
you know that this actor has played bad guys on every single, and I don't know who he is, but you know he's played bad guys on every one of the CSIs, every one of the Law and Orders, Without a Trace, Cold Case, name a CBS procedural, and he has been on it as a bad guy.
Well,
just
yeah,
from
well,
looking at him.
Well, the guy who plays Diego, if you look up his IMDb or his Wikipedia page, it just describes guy who usually plays Southern California gangster. Like, that's he is when you see him, you're like, oh, he's a Southern California gangster. I've seen that guy before. I know who he is. So yeah, but no, this guy's definitely playing to type, no question. And so and as the way they describe it in the making of, at this point, the married couple gets in the back of Sergeant's car, and now as Sergeant says in the making of, it's all the storylines become relevant, because now they're all together, and now they're going to go on their, you know, escape from New York journey, or their running man journey, or whatever you want to think of it as. They're going to try to get across town.
Yep. And which obviously he's going to be annoyed with them the entire time.
Which, by the way, obviously leads to the question, why didn't they go back into the building? Like, she's obviously got, even Callie, got to have friends in the building that potentially could let them in. But instead they're like, no, we need to get the hell out of here.
Well, I think the idea was they knew that it was a government truck, and so they assumed that reinforcements was going to be coming. And since they attacked them the first time, Or it's just a plot hole.
Or and plus were there more paramilitary in the building? Were there they did just blow the doors off of their apartment, so maybe they're freaked out about going back in. I feel like at that point now we're launched into the rest of the film. Like, this is, we're now completely left from the ordinary world, and now we're thrust into the middle of the night in the middle of the purge.
Mm-hmm.
So my favorite parts of this film both happen on rooftops, and they're not major parts of the film. But that right at the beginning, as the Purge Night is being set up, and, as the siren's going off and the emergency alert system is going off on people's televisions, which is so quaint, by the way, the fact that people are watching,
in 2023.
Are watching terrestrial television and getting emergency alert systems. I guess that's relevant for grandparents and stuff, but whatever. So as all this stuff is going on, they're setting up who are the people that are going to be committing all this violence? And so it's street gangs, it's paramilitary, it's, just individuals that want to release the beast. But there's one person who is especially chilling, given what happened at Las Vegas. There was a guy that sets up on a rooftop with a sniper rifle and a six pack.
Then he's just guzzling his first beer.
Oh, man. That just, watching that, I'm like, I don't know. And that obviously tells you a little bit about me, where I see the rest of it and I'm like, whatever. Like, MS-13, street gangs, Crips and Bloods, meh. But you show me a white dude in a fucking camo hat and a sniper rifle on a roof, and I'm like, ugh. Ugh.
And so was your other favorite scene, the woman who was also just screaming rhetoric up on the roof and just taking out anyone who approached.
Oh man, you could imagine that could have been a role for Roseanne Barr on Ambien. Like, it was just a mad woman. I think she says, I'm the left hand of the government and the right hand of God, and she's just firing a machine gun into the air. The writing in that is, I think, the best writing of any part of the film. Her rant on the top of that roof just made me like, oh, it's poetry.
It does give you chills, because we've all seen the YouTube videos.
Well, okay. So
can I just go off on a tiny YouTube tangent real quick?
Do it.
So back when I lived in Ohio, there was this local grocery store called IGA, where I would go to get a pound of turkey, they sliced meat for you, essentially. And the woman behind the counter, whose name was Caroline, I always knew that there was something a little crazy in her eyes. And so I moved to LA, and then 2 weeks before Obama's second election took place, I was just clicking through YouTube videos at work, trying to put off working. And I saw a video of Caroline, and she sounded exactly like she's being interviewed by some Republican something or other. And she sounds exactly like that woman on the roof. She was like, I am God! And I was like, that's Caroline. She used to slice my ham.
That's so funny. I mean,
I hope she's okay now.
Yes, there is definitely an aspect of that sort of that weird mental illness that some of us catch. And unfortunately, people used to have all this mental illness. I know it. I used to see it in my, members of my family would have it, and it would be like, okay. But it used to just happen in a house, and the only way you could get it out of your house is either you had to see somebody and say something crazy to them, or you had to write a letter to the editor. And the editor could just be like, nah, I'm not, that's crazy, I'm not going to publish it. Now it's like, yeah, no, you want to be crazy one day? You lose it for a week, you can just memorialize it.
Yeah, put it up on you. You can get a channel with 3 million subscribers immediately.
And the flip side of it, and this is reiterated several times in the film, the flip side of it is this bizarre nexus in gun culture of Jesus, AR-15s, and my constitutional rights. It's like, what? Why the fuck are those three somehow connected? What part of your brain got wired that those three have anything to do with each other? It's fascinating.
wait, people jumping to conclusions about what the government stands for.
And so then it's great because the rest of the film, there are multiple occasions where... Oh, no. So that happens between the two major points. There are two major points where individuals say, it is my government-given right to purge. And it's my government-given and God-given right to purge. And it's just like, what the fuck?
And more than that, near the end, when we're in the most dangerous game-specific section of the film, when they pray before they finally purge, and they're like, thank you, God, for the right to... And that's doubly terrifying. And of course, it's so on-the-nose specific that it seems over the top. And then you remember... Hey, we do sing a Star-Spangled Banner before every one of our baseball games, and as I'm sure most of our listeners know, the song is a little bit racist. So why is this crazy and over the top? It totally could be quote-unquote realistic given the circumstances.
Yeah, I'm actually a pretty patriotic guy, but like John McCain came out and was like, there is no way that the Pentagon should be paying the NFL John McCain, a guy who was tortured by the Vietnamese, and regardless of whatever his later political stances were or whatever the current president says, was an absolute hero.
Exactly.
And sacrificed himself, intentionally sacrificed himself and submitted himself to pain to protect the people around him. And he has had very vocal stance opposed to the fact that the Pentagon should not be paying money before football games to basically indoctrinate people, during sports events. That part I didn't necessarily make the connection, but yeah, no, this weird nexus between, this weird nexus between patriotism and the Constitution on the one hand, and then religion, Christianity is
and
a pretty
Second Amendment
priestful
and
religion, and an aggressively incorrect reading of the Second Amendment. it's pretty awesome, and the film like takes a point blank aim at it, and it is kind of great that it sells itself as this death wish, conservative action film, Falling Down. I mean, it looks a little bit like Falling Down. And you think you're getting this thing, and then you sit down and it's like, no, man, because at the end, I didn't pick this up the first time I saw it, but the second time I saw it, Callie looks at Carmelo Johns at the end of the Most Dangerous Game scene and looks at him and says, this is the natural... this is the natural outpouring of capitalism, or something like that. And
yeah, some variation on that.
And I was like, wow, they just said this was late stage capitalism. I did not know they were going to go that far to actually say it. Good for them.
Yeah, and then if you are watching it, assuming that it's Falling Down or assuming it's Death Wish, the hero doesn't even get to kill the bad guy who he's wanted to kill the entire movie. Even worse, the bad guy turns out to have redeemed himself and attempts to save our hero who has been trying to murder him the entire movie.
Yeah, that's the ultimate switcheroo at the end. Is basically, oh gosh, basically the hero's journey, Sergeant's journey, is that he learns to choose forgiveness over vengeance. He decides that the being the good guy with the gun is total bullshit, and that is the thing that saves him. And that is the thing that, when watching it, you believe, like, okay, so that's what's going, that's what's going to help the community eventually to get rid of this purge thing, is the people's better natures are going to win out. In fact, the reason why the government, Big Daddy is actually part of the government running around in these trucks and killing people, the reason why the government gets involved is because people themselves are not killing enough people to make money. Now, that's ridiculous. Like, that part of the plot, that's a pretty serious plot hole.
Yes.
People are not going to...
Four steps too far.
Yeah. But the idea is that it's the government itself that needs to do all these things because people by themselves are actually too decent to go around and kill people enough.
Yeah, it's... In the end, it turns out that the film called The Purge Anarchy is about empathy. Who would have thunk?
So, yeah, no, it's... So what are the... You said that there were some things about the film that, while the film outperformed your expectations, and while it had, like, it did a lot of things right, it's pretty clear that for the budget was $8.8 million. It was definitely... So there are a few things about the budget around this. Blum, I listened to this great podcast that Blum did, and he shared his three rules of making money. One of them is pay the main actors, pay them the absolute least amount possible, but give them performance bonuses if the movie makes money. And the idea behind it is if you make a bomb and you lose $5 million, okay, but then if you make a mega hit, like he's made so many of them, and it's $100 million, well, then bumping the budget up to $10 million isn't such a bad thing. And so...
Yeah, and then you get people like Ethan Hawke who are household names, but they're not A-list anymore, so they can legitimize movies like The Purge, like Sinister, like In the Valley of Violence, and give it a pedigree that a film would not normally... get that's just released into the ether.
So this film I think was $11.1 million, but then there were some tax credits from LA because this film was shot on location in Los Angeles, and apparently this is just something that Blum is really good with. He knows sort of how to shoot in LA on a budget, which is I think pretty cool. Adds a lot to the film because you don't need to hire helicopters when you shoot in L.A. at night. They're just going to be police helicopters flying around anyways.
They're just going to be there. I'm in Koreatown right now. I'm shocked I don't hear one outside.
And the film made, what, $111 million? I mean, just absolutely printing money. And this is something that, this is like a magic trick that he's pretty adept at pulling off.
Yes. It's just ingenious. Why can't we all be Jason Blum? Really?
But the thing that's impressive on a $10 million budget to just have so much tension, so much action, and have it be so effective throughout is definitely impressive.
And it's quite stylish. The shot where Sargent is just, pardon me, not Sargent, where the married couple are running and the purge has started and you just see the completely empty LA street. It seems like the movie is mega budgeted. Like, that 2 to 4 minutes of film, probably if the movie was $100 million, they would have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on CGI and stuff like that. But instead, the writer-director realizes that, no, the stillness is what's going to sell it. And the shots look incredible.
Yeah, it's, there's definitely some of that. Some of the stuff that you can see where you can see some of the money, where they're saving some of the money. The CGI, the only place that has CGI really is the blood, is when people are shot. Those bullets are CGI, and that's not really like top-notch CGI.
When Diego is shot, like the bullet holes on him move.
Yeah, they just look like red, like somebody did like a red doodle on photo edit on their iPhone.
And it would have cost less money to actually just put in squibs. So why didn't they put in squibs?
Yeah, that was something I was wondering the same thing too. I assumed that maybe when you just get really cheap CGI, it's actually even cheaper than squibs. But who knows? I don't know.
By the way, I love that we are agreeing this entire time.
Yeah,
I was terrified that I was going out on this limb, and then when the podcast was going to start, you were going to be like, so convince me that this was a decent movie.
I'm actually really glad you mentioned that, because I don't think that I don't think the first time I watched this film I loved it. I think a couple of things made me really enjoy it. First of all, I am particularly politically activated at the moment because of when we're recording this right now, Justice Kennedy has just resigned, and so people are starting to leap ahead in their imaginations about what a DJT Supreme Court is going to be like. Several recent decisions have come down that have been pretty, that feel like major steps backward. I've officiated two gay weddings, and some of the people that I've officiated their weddings are reaching out to me being like, do you think these will be legitimate in 5 years? You know, and then on top of that, the news story broke about families being separated and children being put in what are essentially prisons. And the president doubled down, you know, he pulls the double down and being like, no, I didn't do this. This isn't happening. And yeah, it is happening, but we're supposed to do this because they're all MS-13 and all this
and
pure insanity.
Fault.
Yeah. So all this pure insanity is happening. I'm fired up. And so watching this film right now, there is like some real liberal catharsis I'm getting from it. The other thing that makes me really enjoy this film was immediately after watching the movie, I went back and looked at Jason Blum and started realizing, because I knew that he had done Get Out. I didn't know he had done Whiplash, but I knew he had done Get Out, and I sort of knew that he had done other low-budget films that made a lot of money. I didn't realize, like, that he is full-on fucking Roger Corman, you know, in the 2000s era. Like, I didn't realize just what a, you know, what a money-making machine this guy is. And reading about him is, you know, kind of exciting because I like Roger Corman. I like his business model. And I've certainly thought, like, oh, why isn't somebody doing that today? And so to see this guy doing it and to see, like, how cool some of his movies are that he's putting out, this, like, opens up a whole new world for me.
Well, welcome to the world. I have several that I will just recommend that you do for your next film.
Oh, yeah. Drop. So you already mentioned Hush was a big one that you really like. Oh, I haven't seen Split. So Jason Blum in 2017 was absolutely crushing it, because both Split and Get Out were like low budget films, $4.5 million for Get Out, and I don't even know how much for Split, and they both made like $250 million.
Mm-hmm.
That's insane.
Don't forget about Happy Death Day, which made I think $125 to $150 million too,
and had one of the best trailers of all time with that 50 Cent song and that doll mask. I'm like whoever this guy is just crushing it.
Yes, absolutely crushing it, but in a good way, because you know who isn't rooting for M. Night Shyamalan to have a comeback. After he's been raked through the fires for 9 years straight, who doesn't want him to prove everyone wrong and just actually create a good thriller again?
Man, if there's... Okay, so talk about things that are, like, all-American. You know, that gun, religion, constitution nexus. Another thing that is all-American is, like, when you see somebody successful, you really, really want him to fail. And then, once they failed, you really want to see them have a comeback.
Yeah, you're like, come on, M. Night, please. We know it's inside you. You've done it 4 times before. You can do it again.
And I feel like getting the call from Jason Blum is that like get out of jail free card.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get the call, you're like, oh, okay, everything's going to be okay.
Yeah, and he's also like just allowing people to take chances. He's doing Black Klansman later this fall. Spike Lee's comeback movie. So he's like, you know what? Whoever wants to come into my house, feel free to give it a shot. Try as many crazy things as possible. And if it works, congratulations. And if not, I just won't release it.
Yeah. And Blum's connection to John Carpenter is only growing because doing the Halloween remake.
Yes.
With David Gordon Green, and which I have to say, I like David Gordon Green a lot. I saw him present at Harvard Film Archive. And just a super interesting guy. I loved Eastbound and Down. So I'm totally excited for a Halloween remake.
I have read the script, and you should be excited.
This is a Last year was a great year for horror, and there's no reason to believe that this year won't be just as good or even better. We have that amazing-looking Suspiria remake is coming out.
From the director of Call Me By Your Name.
Fuck Suspiria. Yes. And I've already been on the record. The thing that... So I was already excited. Do you know how to pronounce his last name? I know the first name is Luca.
Nope.
Okay, so I can't pronounce his last name. But that Italian director of Call Me By Your Name, great film of last year. And then I was really excited to... I love Suspiria. I was really excited to see his remake. And then I watched the trailer. And not only is the trailer beautiful and austere, and from what I've heard, it's really terrifying, and it's got a lot of body horror in it. These are all, like, checking off my boxes. But then when I saw that there is definitely going to be a communism, like, post-Nazism, East Germany, RAF, like, storyline going on, oh, that made me so happy. Well, not no.
You had a little orgasm. It's okay. You can say
not East German because it's Austrian. It's Austrian. but yeah, no. I was like, yes, this is so great.
And none of these movies would have been possible aside from the fact that Blumhouse is creating this renaissance of horror and A24. We can't discount A24, which did Hereditary and. What was the film that they made last year that was so, a ghost story, films like that, we can't discount them.
Well, A24 is huge, absolutely, but A24 is making the prestige stuff. They're putting out the prestige stuff.
Yeah, they're doing The Witch.
Yeah, whereas this is, Blumhouse is like, this is, everybody is going, you know, all the teenagers are going to come see this film. No, this year we've had A Quiet Place, Hereditary, and we're going to get Halloween is going to come out later. And then the Suspiria remake looks like it could be, you know, totally next level, top shelf, scary, as well as art house. Like, just, this could be a very good year.
And the fourth Insidious movie was quite good as well.
So I haven't seen any of the Insidious stuff.
I know you haven't. The third one is amazing. You should watch it.
I will. I promise. The third one
has... For my money, one of the best suspense sequences of the past probably decade. It's this girl has broken both of her legs, so she's trapped in an apartment, and she knows that the apartment upstairs is haunted. So, like I said, it's Rear Window with ghosts.
Yep.
And there's the sequence where the ghost comes down and attacks her, and it throws her off the bed, and her casts are cracking. And then it's a very quiet sequence where the ghost goes to the window, and he slowly takes down each one of the blinds. And then all that's left is the light from the girl's computer, and then he slowly closes the computer. And then we just hear the girl screaming, and it's so terrifying.
So I did the thing that I do sometimes where I ask the question, but then I launch into something else, and so I don't wait enough for the answer. So I have down Hush, Paranormal Activities 2 and 3, and the Insidious series. Are there any of the other...
Just watch Insidious 3.
Great.
The first two are okay. The third one is great. If you haven't seen Creep, which is on Netflix, Creep is great. It's a found footage horror movie that is directed by Patrick Bryce, and it stars Mark Duplass as a serial killer who puts out a Craigslist ad that says, "Hey, I'm a serial killer. I need a friend." And the guy comes, and then it's a back and forth as to, is the guy going to murder him? Is he not going to murder him? And it's one of those films that is both terrifying and quite funny.
Oh, I love it.
And I'm just looking through the Town That Dreaded Sundown is great if you're in the mood for meta-horror. It's the premise of the remake is that the original film exists, and a copycat serial killer is coming to town to attack everyone. It's a Ryan Murphy produced film, so it has that sort of meta contextualization. It's Alfonso Gomez Rajon, who directed The Dying Girl, Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl. So it's that sort of film. And I'm looking through. There are several. Split's very, very good. Get Out, of course, is very good. So there's a ton, but if you need to just jump in with three or four, go with it. Paranormal Activity 3, go with Split. Go with Insidious Chapter 3.
So that's interesting. So that's not the only film within a film movie that I know that Blum has done, because he did The Green Inferno, and I think that was like the it's an Eli Roth.
Yeah, it's awful.
Cannibal. But it's a cannibal movie named after the movie that was inside of another cannibal movie from the 80s. I think, what is it, Cannibal Apocalypse?
Yes, the one where they
Cannibal
actually
Holocaust. Cannibal Holocaust.
Cannibal Holocaust.
Yeah. So.
It just don't. Never. Walk away.
Man, you and I should just start. You and I should just start our own Blumhouse type thing, and we can just recycle classic movie concepts and just turn them into horror films.
Well, you know, I have that blog where I have the every Monday is a film noir. And then every Wednesday, right now I'm doing the director Tarsem, the guy who did The Cell and The Fall and Nothing Good of late. And then the Fridays are my AFI films, and I'm trying to figure out what I want to do after I finish Tarsem. Because first I did Kurosawa, now I'm doing Tarsem. I was thinking maybe Kenneth Branagh, but as we're continuing to have this conversation, I'm like, maybe I want to do Blumhouse.
Oh, that could be amazing. That could be really, yeah. Really good.
Because, you know, some of them are awful, but there's so many that are better than one would expect.
You should do that, and then let's get Blum on the get him on this podcast, and we can talk to him.
Perfect. And then I'll just get kicked out of the guy, or I'll be like, here's my new blog, guys, and then all of a sudden I am kicked out again, and I don't understand why.
I love it. What do you call it? Is it the Tarsem experience? Is that what you call your?
The Tarsem Odyssey.
So tell everybody what where to find your blog and where to find you. You do a lot of Criterion Reflections. That's where you and I first chatted. We did the Zatoichi Michio Jimbo.
Yes, you thought it was great, and I disagree.
I think it was just because I love Zatoichi so much. And I do. I really enjoyed Zato. And your take on Zatoichi versus Yojimbo is probably the more popular one. I think most people think it's rubbish, but I was just blown away with. I just love Zatoichi so much.
Well, I signed up for, because you guys convinced me to at least give it one more shot. So I signed up to do with David Blakesley. We should mention with David Blakesley the follow up film and the Fyre Festival is the next one, which everyone says is one of the best ones of the series. But you didn't sign up for it. I'll do it alone.
Do you have a date for it?
No, he hasn't reached out
then
yet.
I'll sign up for it. I mean, I don't know that we need to necessarily go through the logistics over this podcast, but David Blakesley, if you're listening, I'm coming back on. So yeah, so tell my listeners who have made it all the way to the end of the episode where they can find you and hear more of more awesomeness.
Well, my name is Robert Taylor. I'm a television writer. I currently write for Spirit Writing Free on Netflix. Season 5 is currently out. I wrote episode 2 of that.
Worked on all 5 seasons, or did you just come on in like season 4?
No, I was with the show since its inception, and I will be on it until its end.
Oh, that's awesome.
So yeah, season 6 should be coming out in August, and in addition to that, I write other stuff. I have some stuff in the pipeline, which I will be able to announce soon. That is super exciting. In addition to that, I have my own delightful blog where, as I mentioned, every Monday is a film noir. I've done about 100 film noirs so far, and I've only barely touched the tip of the iceberg. Every Wednesday, I pick a filmmaker, whether it's writing or direction or cinematography, and then I just explore their entire filmography from the beginning to the end. First, I did all 30 films of Akira Kurosawa, and then I decided to do Tarsem because The Fall is one of my favorite films of all time. Have you seen The Fall?
I have not.
Shot in 27 countries, no CGI in the entire film, and it's unlike anything you'll ever see.
Wow.
And I have 2 more movies of his to finish, and then I have to figure out what's the next deep dive for there, and then on Fridays, I'm going through the AFI Top 100 one at a time.
So can I? So the question that jumps out at me the most is: so you're the TV show that you write for. It's an animated show geared towards young women, young girls.
Yes, all of your nieces, nephews, and godkids yep. will love it. Because even though it's for girls, it's also very action-y.
Awesome. You told me that. But what I'm interested in is, so you're spending all this time looking at art house film, you're looking at, you know, the great American classics, you're looking at noir, you're looking at, I don't even know how you would necessarily classify Tarzan, but you're just looking at all this stuff. Do you find that any of it informs your writing for the show? Like, do you take something that you see in a noir and build it into Spirit Writing Free?
Well, one of the great things about the show is the central premise is it's just these three young girls at the turn of the century who go on adventures with their horses together, and so the style between episodes varies wildly. We can have a comedy one episode where it's who stole the pie from town, and then the next episode is a horse in town is being abused, so we have to rescue the horse before it is murdered. And then the next episode is the girls need to escape a flood before it takes over the entire town. So the fact that you can have different genres in every episode means that I can basically, all of the writers, not just myself, but all of the writers can sort of take different influences and, hey, this is something that really inspired me, let's figure out an episode around this sort of storytelling technique. And our showrunner, Ori Wallington, who is a genius, she wrote for Sex and the City and Veronica Mars and Heroes before she created the show, is very open to that and has a ton of ideas herself. She leads the room incredibly well. So the long answer I just gave you and the short answer is yes.
So I love the first season of Heroes. I think definitely in the second season you see that sort of influence as well where each episode could have a different flavor. What I don't know what your media consumption was like when you were younger, but I know when I was a kid, like, I was a voracious TV watcher. I watched everything.
Yes, I watched all the TV.
I basically, you know, I was one of those kids. My mom worked all the time, and we spent a lot of time at home by ourselves or with, like, really young babysitters. Like, you know, my uncle was, like, 16, and so he was basically just listening to records and smoking pot when he was ostensibly watching us. And so I spent a lot of time just watching TV or watching TV movies. We always had HBO, even though we did not have a lot of money. We always had HBO, so there's always stuff to watch. What's interesting is when you get older, you start reading books, you start looking at Shakespeare, watching the classic films. You're like, oh, shit, like, I know what this is. I know what's going to happen here because I saw the TV show that's, you know, three degrees of separation from that movie.
Yes.
And so I find it interesting that, you know, kids are sort of being like backwards introduced to a lot of the classics by watching stuff that seems like, you know, it's a cartoon or it's a, you know, a TV show for kids. It still has a lot of the same stories.
Yeah, I in addition to Spirit and my own writing, I'm also a professor of film at New York Film Academy and a couple other places, and I teach a screenwriting class, and the very first thing I do in the first class is I tell them, this is exactly how 98% of films are structured, and then I say, here's Act 1, here's Act 2, here's Act 3, and it truly is as if a bomb has gone off in their mind. They're like, wait, what? And I'm like, give me a movie, and they're like, Dark Knight, and then I will fill it out for Dark Knight, and then they'll be like, but what about Inglourious Basterds? And then I plug in all the plot points of Inglourious Basterds and what I've just written on the board. And they're like, what? What do you mean?
Oh, that's awesome. So what are...
No, you're awesome.
Thank you. That is true. I had a really... So we got to meet up when I visited Santa Monica. And we had a really nice dinner and chat. I actually got to go on your Instagram account for some of the Spirit Riding Free fans. And I also had like my first Topo Chico over at that Blue Star Taco.
So yes, I passed Blue Star Taco the other day. I was going to stop in, but I decided not to because it just wouldn't have been the same without it.
I love Santa Monica. If I ever
am, it's so nice.
If I ever move from Boston, like I will work a soul sucking job to make sure that I can live near Santa Monica. That place is amazing.
It's everyone's happy place.
Yeah, you get to watch the sunset over the Pacific Ocean virtually every day. It's amazing. So let's wrap up. You've been really gracious with your time, and this has been awesome chatting with you. So let's end off with, tell me what some of the movies are that you're interested in watching, either at the movie theater coming up or any of the like Blu-rays coming out, or what are some of the movies that are on your radar right now?
Well, as you alluded to earlier, I'm super excited for Suspiria. It's this weird wild card where who knows how great it's going to be, and I just hope it's going to be absolutely wonderful. I just saw Annihilation, which I did not like as much as everyone else did. Did you see it?
I did, and I am right now, it could very well, it's like between that and First Reformed as my two top choices for films I've seen so far this year.
Well, I'm not trying to, you know, piss on your parade.
I won't tell you to pee on my parade, but I also won't say that I'll be particularly angry if you do.
Well, the thing that fundamentally didn't work for me, and I love Ex Machina, and so I went in with very high expectations, and the movie has great things in it. The scene in the cabin with the wolf creature was... there are things in it that are masterpiece level. But for a film all about loss of identity... God, Natalie Portman didn't have a character to begin with. So why should we give a shit if she loses who she is? That was my fundamental issue with it. And we know Natalie Portman's a great actress. We know that if they had given her a character that she could have sunk into, it would have been great. But that was my issue with it. So I saw Quiet Place, which I very much liked. I saw Jurassic World, which is a movie. I saw Hereditary, which I thought was wonderful, and I'm very happy it's doing as well as it did because it's so fucked up and dark that I thought it would never break through, but it did. So yay. I saw A Wrinkle in Time, which is a very, very weird, trippy movie that's not very good, but is also kind of great. And... Tully is coming out, and I really want to see Tully. I didn't, unfortunately, get to see it in theaters because it was only in for 2 weeks when I was ill. But I really... Have you seen Tully yet?
No, so Tully was at Sundance this year, and I saw... Oh, gosh, why am I blanking on her name? Is it Dakota Fanning? Or Dakota Johnson? No, Diablo Dakota Cody. Johnson. No, it's Diablo Cody. Oh, my gosh. And and Reitman... they were there, and they were just hilarious. And so I was like, I'm really excited to see it. I just didn't get around to seeing it. I didn't get to see it in Sundance. My friends did. They liked it. And I didn't get to see it when it was out in theater, so I'm going to have to catch it definitely soon.
Yeah, it just was in and out of theater so quickly, unfortunately. I will say, and then this will be my last recommendation, my biggest surprise of the year, a movie that I had no expectations for, and I went in and I was like, holy fuck, this is great, was Game Night with Jason Bateman and Rachel McAdams. Every scene was smarter than it had to be. It worked. If they would have played it as a straight thriller, it would have worked. But they didn't. They played it for comedy, and it was so well cast. It was so well acted. It was stylishly directed. And they did, like, Vacation before this. So I had no expectations that it was going to be good, and then it was, and I loved it. Did you see it?
I did not. So one of the takeaways from Purge Anarchy in this podcast, and it's something that I've noticed before, is that I make decisions when I see films. I see their trailers, and I sort of get a sense of what I think they are, and I just decide that's not a movie that can be good. You know, like Girls' Night is another one where I think, oh, geez, a movie about a bunch of girls going out and partying, like, that's not going to be any good. And everything I've heard, it's been amazing. This Purge Anarchy film. And there are a bunch of films where, definitely Game Night, where I look at it and I'm like, there's no way that movie can possibly be good. And yet, there are plenty of people, I've heard mixed reviews about it, but there are plenty of people that are like, it's terrifically hilarious. Plus, doesn't it have Justin? Isn't Justin Theroux in it?
Justin Theroux is not in it. However, it has, God, what's the name of the actor from Fargo and USS McAllister? The guy with the, why can I not think of his name? Hang on. You just talk or sing for 2 seconds while I look up his name so I don't look like an idiot. It is Jesse Plemons. There we go.
Could you
it
imagine?
Has Jesse Plemons in it.
Do you have any do you have any idea how bad ahead. It would be if I sang? You don't. I'm asking. It's a stupid rhetorical question. It would be awful if I sang.
Sing some Beyonce for us.
Jesse Plemons. He was in. Breaking Bad.
He's literally in everything now.
Oh, it's Kyle Chandler. It wasn't Justin Theroux. It was Kyle Chandler.
Kyle Chandler's the brother. But Jesse Plemons has sort of turned into the new John Goodman in that every single person hires him for everything. He's in the Spielberg movie, he's in the Post, he's in Bridge of Spies, then everyone on TV is hired. He's in, like, Fargo, he's in Black Mirror, he's in Breaking Bad, he's in Olive Kitteridge. Like, everyone's hiring him for everything, and that's because he's such a good actor.
Yeah, there are a few actors like that where you just can't escape him. Like, what is his name? Domhnall Gleeson?
Yeah, he's all over right now, and, God, what's Caleb, his name? Adam Driver.
Adam Driver's in everything. Caleb Landry Jones is in everything. It's good out there for some of the young actors. That's awesome. So that's definitely the takeaway, is I need to stop judging movies by their cover, or their trailer, or whatever it is that I'm judging them by, and... just go out and see a bunch of films and be okay with the fact that some of them are going to be awful. But, you know, you also get the opportunity to find great surprises like Purge Anarchy. So,
yeah, I watch everything. Criterion is a huge part of my life. The art house films are a huge part of my life. But why not watch the Purge Anarchy? What's wrong with the Purge Anarchy?
It's just like going to the supermarket. I make sure that every time I go to the supermarket, I buy at least one thing that I've never bought before. Just because...
What did you buy the last time you went to the supermarket?
Oh, gosh. The last time it was some beef jerky that I had never tried before.
And was it good?
I haven't eaten it yet. I've been eating a lot more than I should lately. But I'm gonna get back.
And Insta and Facebook John, and ask him how this beef jerky thing was. This will be our big cliffhanger at the end of the episode. What will he think of the beef jerky? Find out next time.
That's great. Hey Robert, it's you're one of the, not only are you super just widely versed in film and really intelligent, but also one of the funniest guys that I've heard podcasting. Your Criterion Now episode was terrific, and I'm really glad that you took the time out of your day to come on the podcast.
As long as you keep complimenting me like this, I am happy to return whenever you would like.
Fantastic. Hey Robert, stay safe.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful Purge night.